Chapter 4. Governor Bush Runs for President. While governor of Texas, George W. Bush used to say he thought it was the best job in the world. For the most part, I believe he really meant it, and knowing Bush the way I do today, I have come to appreciate why. Now, it is important to understand first that the Texas governorship is an inherently weak office constitutionally. The Constitution of 1876, written after the end of the Reconstruction period, when most Texans still harbored great resentment toward the centralized autocratic Republican administration that was imposed on them after the Civil War, substantially diminished the governor's powers in decentralized state government. The new Constitution distributed power among an array of independently elected state office holders, along with a part-time legislature. This so-called plural executive limits what the governor can do on his own, since the other officials with whom he shares power are elected on their own, are free to act independently, and may not entirely support his agenda. Nonetheless, the Texas governorship does carry significant influence if the person occupying the office knows how to use the bully pulpit effectively. The Texas governor also has the power of the veto, as well as the ability to appoint a significant number of individuals to powerful and prominent positions within state government, including university boards and key regulatory commissions. And he or she can call special sessions of the legislature, which in Texas's unique, some might say odd, system otherwise meets for only 4.5 months every other year. Relative to its power, the office also has a large staff and other perks and privileges, such as a mansion, a security detail, and the use of state government-owned planes. And it is considered the most prestigious state office, receiving far more media attention and public interest than any other. The office suited Bush's personal style well. He is someone who enjoys living a full and balanced life, and, like most politicians, he finds being around people invigorating and uplifting. He also values discipline and routine in his schedule. The power of the office gave him the ability to do something meaningful and fulfilling, influence the state's direction in a positive way. Its largely predictable and normal hours, coupled with its perks and privileges, gave him great flexibility to balance work, exercise, and leisure time. As we all should, Bush places great importance on daily exercise. I remember one day in 1997 when I was working at LCRA and had predictable normal hours myself. Back then, before suffering a knee injury, I used to run 3 to 4 miles a day. I had taken my lunch hour to go running on the nearby Town Lake Trail in Austin. As I was stretching and walking across the trail, just before starting my run, a guy in hat and sunglasses flew right by me. I might not have noticed him, but for the fact that he nearly plowed me over, which caused me to turn and see who it was. I saw a couple of guys follow on mountain bikes and another on foot. The guy in the hat was Governor Bush, who was sprinting as he finished his run for the day, and the guys trailing him were part of his protective detail. Bush also used to like lifting weights at the nearby UT athletic facility around lunch hour a few times a week and had the flexibility to be able to do so. The prestige of his job provided him frequent access to a wide range of people, especially good, ordinary Texans, whom he could meet, greet, and address in speeches. I imagine there are few people, given the same opportunity, who would not enjoy such a prestigious, influential, and largely comfortable job. I found working for Bush in the governor's office beginning in early 1999 to be rewarding and challenging. There were always a variety of issues or events to address, including his all but officially announced presidential campaign. In my position as Deputy Communications Director, I had frequent interaction with Governor Bush as I responded to press inquiries, attended public events with him in Austin and around the state, and wrote press releases and statements for him, among other duties. I started getting to know him as a person and a leader and began to form a personal bond with him. A governor's entourage, unlike that of a U.S. president, tends to be intimate and fairly small, and Bush always preferred it that way. He never much cared for a lot of people trying to handle him, follow him, or tell him where to go or what to say. On trips as governor, it was not uncommon for him to be accompanied only by a personal aide, his spokesman, and 2 or 3 members of his protective security detail, who were the best officers the Texas Department of Public Safety had to offer. There are a few moments that I still remember well from those 6 months I spent in the governor's office before heading over to the presidential campaign. It was in the governor's communications office that I first confronted a life-and-death policy issue, the death penalty. Governor Bush took a pretty tough line on stays and commutations. He believed that the death penalty helps save innocent lives through its deterrent effect. In his view, if the convicted felon had been afforded full access to the courts and there was no question about his or her guilt, then it was not the governor's place to overrule a jury. In any case, By state law, his options were limited to one 30-day stay, and he could commute the sentence only if he received a recommendation to do so from the Texas Pardons and Parole Board, whose members are appointed by the governor. As a spokesman, I had to respond to inquiries about specific cases as well as questions about how Governor Bush reviewed them before signing death warrants. As the son of a former president and a possible future presidential contender, George W. Bush attracted more national scrutiny than other Texas governors had. Issues related to the death penalty were among the more contentious. Texas resorts to execution at a higher rate than any other state in the Union, and during Bush's tenure as governor, the death penalty was implemented 152 times, a number that caused considerable controversy. Those executed include a handful of felons whose IQs were below what is often considered the threshold for mental retardation, as well as Carla Faye Tucker, a born-again Christian whose 1998 case attracted pleas for clemency from Pope John Paul II and prominent conservatives including Newt Gingrich and Pat Robertson. In any case, the death penalty was probably the first significant issue I had to deal with directly in the media where my view was not in line with Bush's. While I firmly believe in taking a tough stance on crime, I've always harbored some doubts about capital punishment. My thinking is grounded in a moral belief. I'm deeply troubled by the idea that even one innocent person could fall through the system and be put to death for a crime that he or she did not commit. I believe life without parole, which segregates convicted criminals from society, can serve the same purpose, keeping that individual from ever harming another innocent person without forcing society to play a role that I believe is not ours to play. Such a convicted felon should be held in virtual solitude under maximum security and treated humanely, but with few, if any, privileges of a free society. I also question, as have studies over the years, whether the death penalty has much of a deterrent effect. To be clear, I'm not staunchly anti-death penalty. If ever there is a case in which it is deserved, it would be those responsible for planning the 9/11 attacks. For me, the issue is too complex and too nuanced for a black and white position, but I do feel significant doubts about it, much as I would later feel about the necessity of war in Iraq, another life and death policy matter where I was called on as official spokesman to defend a position despite inner qualms about it. I didn't express my doubts about the death penalty publicly. After all, I was speaking for the governor, not myself. He was an unapologetic supporter of the death penalty, a position he had clearly articulated while running for the governorship and which the majority of Texans supported. Furthermore, the death penalty was Texas law. Even if the governor had not agreed with it, he had an obligation to uphold the laws of Texas and carry them out faithfully. For all these reasons, I told myself my personal doubts didn't really matter. On Governor Bush's behalf, I issued statements defending his position and responded to the controversies the way he wanted me to. That's what a spokesman does. Another notable moment occurred when a stricter Texas law against driving while intoxicated was passed. After determined lobbying by leaders of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, MAD, the Texas legislature passed a law in 1999 lowering the blood alcohol limit in Texas from 0.10 to 0.08. I remember suggesting to Karen Hughes that it might be good to hold a public signing ceremony for the bill so that the governor could underscore the importance of the new law. Karen replied, "Oh, he won't want to do anything public on it. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I think there is something in his past." I found her response notable, but didn't think a lot more about it at the time. I'm not sure exactly why. Probably the press of daily business simply pushed the issue to the side, until later events just before Election Day in 2000 made me recall the exchange with Karen and think about it in a new light. Overall, my time in the governor's office was a good experience. I learned a lot about government, politics, and the art of communication. I helped support an administration that was producing good bipartisan results for the state and the people of Texas. And I was playing a meaningful role in the career of a promising politician considered by many people to be a possible future president of the United States. All of this was heady, exciting stuff. I enjoyed some delightful moments of personal bonding with Bush, flying on a small plane with just the two of us sitting up front or chatting with him in the governor's office. One of my favorite moments occurred on the day I was the first to arrive for a meeting to review bills from the just-completed legislative session that the governor might veto. Since I had arrived early, the governor invited me back to the kitchen where he was fixing himself one of his favorite lunches, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Dressed down in a white t-shirt and blue jeans sans shoes, he asked if I wanted a sandwich. I said sure, and he fixed it for me. For the next 20 minutes or so, we munched on the sandwiches and talked about a variety of topics, few of which had to do with politics. Not long after I was beginning to settle into the quieter times in the governor's communications office following the legislative session and the bill signing period that succeeded it, Karen Hughes, then communications director for the Bush 2000 campaign, asked me to make another move. This time, in late July 1999, it was to join the now full-throttle presidential campaign as a deputy press secretary. Someone was needed to help fill the void left by departing national spokesman David Beckwith, a veteran Washington political communicator and former vice presidential spokesman. I had come to know Beckwith back in 1992 when he worked in Texas for then U.S. Senate candidate Kay Bailey Hutchison. I liked Beckwith, but Karen viewed him as a loose cannon who was less cautious and was not as on message as she preferred. Karen had come to trust me to proceed cautiously and stay on message, and she felt I had a good sense of the tone Bush preferred to set in his comments. I gained some valuable experience dealing with the national press during the lead-up to the primaries and early primary states. I spent most of my time responding to press inquiries from a variety of journalists and news organizations, both in person and on the phone, and participating in communications strategy meetings.